So I'm excited to finally share this conversation with you. It's one of those things that I did and then had some other things come up, and then it had been long enough that I felt embarrassed that I didn't have it done yet, and then that made me put it off more. Anyways, these dumb things happen to us, don't they? So this is a conversation with Jeff Monroe about his book, which is about grief and suffering and pain. And the beauty of the book for me, and Jeff, I think, mentions this in the conversation, but it's not a book about the why of pain and suffering and grief and death. It's a book about the how of those things, which is relevant to all of us, because we will all go through, or have gone through most likely, pain, suffering, depression, all the things, all the hard things about being human in this world, which I think Jeff would say, and I would say, is a real privilege. It's a real privilege to have an opportunity at existence. But what do we do about the fact that there is this looming possibility, and to some degree, inescapable truth, which is that pain and death are a part of this system, which is amazing in so many ways. And so we talk through that, and some of our conversation here and there is talking about Christianity and what it has to offer to this conversation, which is a part of Jeff's book. I don't think it's heavy-handed, but depending on your perspective or your current relationship with Christianity, you may find that you skip over some of those parts. I don't know. I just want to say that that's there, so that if you choose to read it, you know that. And to say that for me, whose current relationship to Christianity is strained, that was not a problem for me in reading and appreciating and learning very many things from this book. So I recommend this conversation, which I think is a very honest conversation about this very honest book, because it's about this very real thing in reality that we all experience, pain and suffering and death. And I also want to recommend Jeff's book. So it's Telling Stories in the Dark, Finding Healing and Hope in Sharing Our Sadness, Grief, Trauma, and Pain. Author is Jeff Monroe. And this is our conversation about that book.
So I said that, you know, when I worked in institutional life, when we faced a crisis, we would go to the, you know, the first call would be to the attorney.
That's right.
Yeah. Instead of calling the, the theologians or the ethicists, and we had them in the building.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, we were interested in how do we make sure that we protect the institution. Yeah. I do know where that is. That's in the chapter on medical error.
Got it.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
The chapter with the gentleman whose daughter.
Yeah. Quinice.
Died
via, yeah. And error. Yeah. And
that, how did you say? How do you say his name?
His name is Quentin.
Quentin.
And she's
right.
Quinice.
That's right.
Yeah. And that was a story of the part of the story is that the hospital. And not just that hospital, but hospitals in general, we live in such fear of lawsuits, institutions do, that they don't do what's necessary. They can't do what's necessary to let people know what actually happened.
Right.
When doctors make mistakes, which doctors do, because doctors are human. So people wind up doing lawsuits, not so much because they want to recover the money or get money, but they want to know the truth.
Yeah.
They want to know the story. They
yeah,
want to know what happened.
A woman who went through this process, not because she was trying to get money or trying to create problems for the hospital or the doctor. She just wanted
she wanted to know what happened to her husband.
Her husband, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And even that is guarded.
Right.
Because of the possibility or the fear of a lawsuit.
Right. And some hospitals and some places are experimenting with kind of mediation processes where they can talk to people without saying, okay, we're not here in a legal setting. We're here in a more human setting. And the doctor can say, I made a mistake and I would give anything to undo it.
Yeah.
The medical world, I mean, that's not why we came here today, I'm sure, but the medical world, the pressure on doctors is unlike anything. I mean, maybe airline pilots are the same way.
Yeah.
There are just a few professions where you are expected to be perfect all the time and to never make a mistake. And maybe AI will solve all that for us. Mm. But when there's still people involved, mistakes happen. And
that's right.
And they have really bad consequences. But there are no other, you're ordained, right? Yeah. Do you take out liability insurance?
I don't.
Right. Ministers don't have to take out liability insurance, and they make mistakes all the time.
Yeah.
But they don't have the consequences that medical professionals do.
Yeah. And I'm trying to remember who in that chapter. So the setup of the book is to tell the story of some tragedy, loss, suffering, and then to bring someone else on, sometimes a pastor, sometimes a psychologist or therapist, or a theologian in the case of Nicholas Walterstorff, mm-hmm. and have them reflect on that story and give sort of their wisdom on mm-hmm. it. And in that particular chapter, so it was Quentin and Quenice, mm-hmm. right? Quentin was the father who you were speaking to, who had lost his daughter to a medical mistake. She had cancer, but it was treatable cancer.
Yep.
And they went in to put the port, I think, is that
right?
Right. Yep. To deliver the chemo, and they perforated her heart.
Yes.
And so she ended up dying of something that was a mistake, something that wasn't supposed to happen. She was supposed to be okay after the chemo. And then, who is it that reflects on that with you?
Marilyn McIntyre, who's
Mary.
An author, but has taught medical humanities in California, UC Berkeley and University of San Francisco medical schools. And she's also worked with hospice as a volunteer for years and has written about three or four different books that deal with medical issues and medical sides of things. So she's fantastic in that chapter.
Yeah, I thought
she did a great job.
She was wonderful. And I thought what was wonderful about it, in part, there were many things, but the fact that she could, right, turn our focus not just on the loss here and the suffering of the family who lost their daughter, but also on the fact that sort of hidden from this story, kept in some ways from this family that is suffering, is also some, I don't remember if it was a nurse or a doctor, but multiple people were involved. I mean, if they did radiology, there was a radiologist involved. And those people, based on the system we have, really have no opportunity for some sort of resolution to ask for forgiveness, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
The system just isn't set up that way. And
right.
what a huge loss that is, I think she would say, for everyone involved.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But certainly for doctors and nurses, and that's part of what you're saying, mm-hmm. is the system we have keeps them, well, requires a kind of perfection that's impossible. Mm-hmm. And then when the mistakes are made, there's really no opportunity for resolution of any kind.
Right. So what I tried to do in each chapter is really approach it with the point of view of, I thought of myself as a journalist, mm-hmm. as someone that would ask questions and seek understanding rather than try to present myself as some sort of expert
right.
on any of this. And, I had started with my first approach when I first had the idea of the book was to try to make myself an expert. And I read everything I could on pain and trauma and loss for about 6 months. And then I said, what am I doing?
This is, yeah.
I'm not going to become, one of the, you know, I'm not going to learn in 6 months a lifetime of knowledge that other folks have. And so I just tapped into, I could approach this. I actually set it aside for a while and then came back to it when I had this idea that I could approach this as a reporter and be the one that asks questions instead of presenting myself as the expert.
Yeah. I love your approach in this book. I was thinking, I'll just say really quickly, I was thinking recently of writing a book, and I was trying to think, what could I write that would be of any use? how would I write it? What would it be about? And as I was reading your book, it occurred to me it's somewhat similar to something I've been conceiving, which was to take a mundane, in some ways, experiences from my life, and then from those articulate out the ways in which neuroscience, psychology, which is much of what you're doing here, gives insight that in the ways in which the mundane is not as mundane as mm-hmm. we thought. There's so much happening in our bodies, in other people, in connection, right, in grief and all these things. So I loved the way that you put it together. I thought it was beautifully done.
Thanks.
I think the stories are maybe powerful is the right, just to give a word that doesn't have good or bad attached to it necessarily. Profound, I think, is another word to give to it. So thank you for doing it. I think it's a real gift to anyone. Because, as you say, if there's one thing that connects all human beings, it's pain.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's something really profound in that, what I think is also a truth. Working in Israel Palestine, we work with a group called Parent Circle Family Forum, and one of the people who speaks to our groups often, he lost a daughter, and he says the same thing. He talks about the power of pain and the possibility for connection in pain, but he also mentions, his name is Rami, he also talks about how it's like nuclear energy. It can be used for good.
Yeah,
and it
sure.
can be used for ill.
Yeah.
So I just love that idea of being connected by pain.
And one of the insights that you mentioned, Nicholas Waltersdorf, who is somebody that I talked to, and one of the insights that he had, actually, it came to him originally from Lewis Smead, a name from the past,
right?
But a wonderful writer and thinker, who said, you've heard misery loves company. Well, you're going to find out that grief isolates and that it doesn't necessarily bring you together, that it can divide families. And certainly that's the case, has been the case. There are lots of marriages that end over the death of a child, for example.
Yeah.
It can divide because we all experience things in our own way. And as Nick says in that chapter, my grief was not my wife's grief, was right. not my other children's grief. Each of us have our own experience. And yet the experience of being human profoundly is affected by pain and what we do with pain. And that's another, I guess that's another thing that I was after
Absolutely.
In the book was really the one of the threads that pulled it together for me was to move from the question of why to the question of what.
Mm-hmm.
And early in my life, I experienced some really painful mm-hmm. things. I touch on my wife's stroke a month before we were married.
Yep.
A few years prior to that, my parents had gotten divorced after 27 years of marriage. That was a very difficult thing for me also. Mm-hmm. And so I was really stuck on that, on the what the theologians and philosophers call theodicy questions of why did this happen? And what I've learned over the years is that there is no answer that will satisfy anyone.
That's right.
And I quote, I know you went to Western, right, Josh?
Right.
Yeah. Was Jim Cook on the faculty when you were there, or maybe he'd retired at that point?
I think he was retired, but he did teach a few courses.
He was one of my professors, and in the story about Roger Nelson, a mutual friend of ours,
yep.
you know, Roger tells a story of after his father's murder, coming back to the seminary, and Jim Cook had lost a son horribly to cancer. You know, just he kind of died piece by piece, had multiple surgeries, amputations, all these things in an effort to save his life that were ultimately unsuccessful. And so there was a long, prolonged suffering and then death. And Jim Cook told Roger, if God himself would write on a piece of paper why this had happened, I would wad it up and throw it in his face. That there's never reason enough, whatever reason, and it can be, it could be the most airtight, you know, philosophical reason that you could come up with, but it still won't satisfy us. So the move to just give up the why question and to settle on what do I do with this gift, so to speak, that I've been given, which is where Frederick Buechner, I come in the book with his idea of the stewardship of pain, mm-hmm. which is another one of the threads that ties this together, is what do we do with these things that happen to us, when, especially the extraordinarily painful, traumatic things that happen in our lives? And do they just diminish us, or do they somehow, can they somehow be used redemptively for the good of others, to help others? Can we become more empathetic people? Can we become more generous people, more generative people as a result of the pain that has happened to us?
Mm-hmm. I stumbled on the work of Susan Cain.
Yeah, sure.
Bittersweet.
Yeah.
And what you just articulated, both now and in the book, reminded me so much of her work. And she says something very similar to what you say, which is something like, humans are uniquely suited to transform pain into beauty.
Hmm.
Now, she doesn't say that it's easy.
Right.
She doesn't say that everybody's able to do it. But that we as a creature, as an animal, have this unique ability to do so. And when we do so, it's extremely powerful.
Yeah. Well, I loved her book on introversion.
That's right. Quiet?
Yes.
Is that what it was?
Yes. And because I'm an introvert. And then, I think that's really powerful. It reminds me of a quote that I use real early in this book, that also was one of the threads that helped put it together for me, was from Richard Rohr.
Mm-hmm.
If we do not transform our pain, surely we will transmit it. And we live in a world where we see pain transmitted all the time.
For sure.
Every mass shooting, every people misbehaving on airplanes, or just the way that we talk right now in our public and political discourse that is filled with lashing out and transmitting pain. And we see it in Gaza right now. We see it in Ukraine right now.
There's just
unresolved issues that people haven't worked through, and then creating more pain, and it becomes a snowball effect. And so what does it mean to transform our pain? That was another one of the threads that tied this together for me.
Yeah. And I think it's really, what I like about that is that it's not claiming anything. It's not claiming that pain is redemptive,
mm-hmm.
right? It's not necessarily redemptive, or that it can be transformed, but that possibility exists in a world where pain exists and cannot be undone, right? We might as well look for or imagine the possibility of doing something constructive with it. And I think I was thinking of this book, and I was thinking it's sort of, not to be philosophically and theological here, but it reminds me of something that people call like Christian existentialism. If that term resonates at all with you, and the reason I say that is because this book is so rooted in reality.
Yeah.
Which I think is part of its power, is it's, and this is what you're saying, instead of why, it's the what is reality. right? It's the reality of our lives. It's the reality of our brokenness. It's the reality of our strength, our courage. All of those things are in this book. It just seems so, it honors reality in a way, which I think is so, I don't know. I just think there's something really important about that.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to lump me in with Soren Kierkegaard, I could live with that.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know how he would feel, but,
Well, he would, the reason I mention it is what he would like is the fact that you're starting with existence.
Mm-hmm.
You're starting with experience.
Yeah.
You're starting with people's stories. You're not starting, as you said earlier, which I don't think we got on tape, is that you're not particularly drawn to the abstract.
Yes.
You're drawn to what's real. And I think we're in a moment now where that is the mood. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I can just say the other day I'm in a poetry group. I write poetry, very bad poetry, but I write poetry.
I can say that.
And I love being in this group. But the other day we were reading, a couple chapters on the relationship of poetry and philosophy, and other people just eat that up. And to me, it's like when I read that, my brain is made out of Teflon. Nothing sticks. I can't tell you anything. I read it, 30 pages. I can't tell you what I read. I can't tell you what any of it means. Tell me a story and I'll remember that. That will get to me. I have, Brian Doyle said, we have story-sized holes in our heads and our hearts. And that's really true for me. So stories stick in ways that, propositional truth or abstract thought or philosophy. I'm sorry, I don't want to denigrate. There's great work being done by theologians and philosophers, but it just doesn't get me out of bed in the morning.
Yeah. I'm finding myself moving in your direction, though I spent a lot of time in the theoretical, philosophical, mm-hmm. theological, all that world for a long time educationally. I'm now finding myself just so obviously drawn to the nuts and bolts and the weirdness and the unknowing, the doubt, the confusion, the beauty, just the fullness of reality, which is part of what I think this book is doing. And the reason I mentioned bittersweet is that's, I think, an attempt at that as well, which is to find a way to encompass within our lives as much of reality as possible.
Mm-hmm.
That there's something, I don't know what the right word is for it. Something generative about that, maybe, mm-hmm. is a word. I don't know.
Generative is a great word.
Yeah.
And it's a word.
I mean, this book is an example of all the generative things that are possible when we sort of unapologetically and without leaving people with answers, just give people reality, and in this case, in the form of stories, which I think is super powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that I'm in a group with three other guys. We get together. We were all in seminary together in the 80s, and we get together once a year and spend mm-hmm. a few days, and it's a truth-telling zone. But one of the things that we come back to is generativity. As each of us has is in our 60s now, how do we think of our lives and what do we do that remains life-giving? Because the other option is to, I don't want to denigrate this, but buy a place in Florida and go play golf all day. Mm-hmm. I don't want to sound judgmental, but I am a little bit that, there's got to be more to life than that, that investing in life, investing in the future, investing in the stewardship of pain, whatever concept it is, would bring more meaning out of life than than just sitting and counting your money all day or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I do think there's something about these stories or certain experiences in our life that feel more dense and real than other moments. And I don't really know how to put better words to that. Except to say, when I read stories like this, and I recently read a book by a hospice nurse that I can't remember the name of, but had a similar feel to this, obviously, because she's explaining her experiences with hospice patients. It just feels like, again, this is a difficulty where words fail me. It feels more connected to reality, even though it's scary and painful. I think the upside of it is it is so full of something real. And yeah. I don't know what to, in your book, I would say some people would describe that as the divine is the maybe the extra thing that's mm-hmm. there, or the thing that's there in a deeper, more profound way. I don't know. Does that resonate with you at all?
Yeah, I think we're more alive. I think of Frederick Buechner had an illustration that he used once where he would say that he would have to go drive, and I can't remember the names of the towns. So let's just pick from Holland to Kalamazoo, and you have to drive through Allegan.
I did that a lot.
Yeah.
Because we moved to Holland when I was a junior in high school, and I would go see my friends all the time.
Yeah.
So I know that route well.
Yeah. And so he'd say, there would be days when I would be driving and I would not know if I'd gone through Allegan yet.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He said, it's just too familiar,
he
right?
He said, that's someone not in touch with his reality. I'm just lost.
Exactly.
And so we're going through the motions lost versus something, the pain or these traumatic experiences that you are very much alive in and very much trying to aware of. You know, we use words like time stands still mm-hmm. or things go in slow motion or whatever it is, or even... in the description that Dan Rooks provided, looking at Roger Nelson's story, where Roger was having these out-of-body experiences, even trying to understand the brain science behind that.
That's great stuff.
Yeah, it's fascinating. But yes, it is. You're somehow you're more alive, you're more attuned in these moments than you are otherwise.
Yeah. One of the tensions I felt, and this is probably... that probably has a lot to do with like where I'm at in my, let's just say spiritual journey. Mm-hmm. Right. So I've definitely been a part of the deconstruction crowd, still consider myself.
You were deconstructing before it was popular.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'll take that.
Yeah.
I was, but barely, just barely. And I found myself as I read the book, I would say the book has, it does have a Christian mm-hmm. overlay to it,
yeah.
right? Not necessarily, I wouldn't say it's heavy. I think there's a light touch to it, but it's obviously there. And one of the things that I think Christianity often wants to bring to these situations is the possibility of an ending that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see, for example, and I know this about Roger, I've talked to him personally, he is definitely holding on to that ending in which there'll be some making sense of these things. And I heard it sort of yeah. here and there throughout.
Yeah. They all will be well. And all
that's right.
All manner of things will be well.
That's right.
Yeah.
But I also heard in it, in their experiences, this having to wrestle with a lack, an incompleteness, the fact that wholeness is perhaps available briefly here and there, but we never really feel this wholeness in our lives. And I think there's something profound about putting those things in tension and wondering about them, I guess. And one of the things I wonder is it possible to do away with the notion of all will be well? without losing something critical, do you think?
Yeah. So now we're going into the abstract and the philosophical.
I know, my bad.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's okay.
It's the only abstract.
That's okay. I've been reading Christian Wiman. You know, he's oh my gosh, he's a great writer,
okay.
Poet. Teaches at Yale Divinity School.
Yes.
But
he has NPR lately.
Yeah, he was.
Year?
Yeah,
I heard that
talking about his book.
Yeah. And
Zero.
I started his book. Yeah.
Zero at the Bone.
Oh,
50 Entries Against
unreal.
Despair.
Beautiful.
Right? So,
and he is very much in this place of tension.
Yeah,
it seemed he lives there
deep.
Deep.
Yeah, and so don't go to his book thinking it's going to be the book of delights and is going to make you feel great about everything.
But it's real.
It's very real. Yeah, and so he would be one of those people that would say, and I don't know who said this first, but you know, if you're not depressed, you're not paying attention, right?
I feel that.
Yeah, there is
that.
A lot to despair about.
Yeah.
In our world and the climate. You know, we're sitting here in February.
I know
the sun is shining. It's going to be 50 degrees. It's working out for us, but this is...
Yeah, we just haven't been far enough north.
Yeah,
right?
It's going to kill.
Surrounded by water.
It's going to be
in
a
good
horrible
place.
Thing. Yeah, but so climate despair is very real. Despair over our political discourse, despair over the breakdown of democracy, despair. And so unless you're medicating yourself, mm-hmm. which we do,
sure.
You know, some of us through substances, but others do it through shopping, or through sports, or through whatever diversion you can come up with, to look fully into the horrors of life,
yeah.
is despairing. And Christian Wiman, I should also say, I'll tell you a little story about him.
Please.
So he lives with incurable cancer, and he's almost died from it multiple times. And it's probably coming on 20 years. That he's had this diagnosis and...
Because he's written now two books on...
Multiple
this.
Books
More
that
than two. Okay.
Touch on...
I knew
yeah,
two.
Yeah. Anyway, I tried to interview him for this book.
Sure.
And I wanted to have our mutual friend Tom Bogart reflect on it because Tom just laps up everything he writes. Yeah. And Tom also lives with incurable cancer.
Yeah.
And Christian Wiman said, I'm bored with cancer.
He sort of said that in the fresh
he does,
air.
Yeah. And
in an
like,
interview.
I'm not, I don't want to talk about
right,
it.
Right.
I just don't want, I've just no interest in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So phenomenal and so worth exploring. So I don't know. You asked me a question somewhere in there and there was some
That's
sort
right.
of answer somewhere
That's
in
right,
there.
Right.
I'm
we
not sure it made
tension,
any sense.
The tension created between like acknowledging the reality of the pain and
yeah.
brokenness now. And for some, this hope of a future
right.
in which all
yeah.
all will be well.
Yeah.
I guess if I'm being just like completely transparent, I'm at a place right now where I'm experimenting with the idea of all will not be well necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Can I live
where
with
does
hope
where does hope come from?
And
then?
Beauty
yeah.
and like make the most of this life. Without that peace. And this, and I would say this book helps me explore that possibility more while also sort of pushing me to think about the possibility or to consider the possibility that there is some ending.
Yeah.
But when I think of Jim Cook saying, you know, if God wrote it all down and on a piece of paper, you know, I'd ball it up and throw it back at him. Which is, in a sense, his acknowledgement that what happened to his son cannot be made well.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, it's an acknowledgement that there's no explanation he would accept.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean, I guess, and maybe this is an important point, you tell me, that there isn't an experience that couldn't. Maybe there's an experience that could make it well, but there's not an explanation.
Right. I think that's true. And, you know, another illustration, which is touched on a couple times in the book, is simply the difference between C.S. Lewis writing The Problem of Pain mm-hmm. and then actually having the that's horrific right. experience.
Yeah, because the grief observed is incredible.
Yeah, which he wrote under a pseudonym.
Oh, he did. I didn't know that.
Yeah, he published it originally as I think it's N.W. Clark, because he just couldn't have the C.S. Lewis in the public. Right. This was against, you know, it's long before we used this kind of language, marketing language, but it was off brand,
right,
for him.
Right.
You know, the world was not going to accept that the person who had figured out pain was overwhelmed by it and couldn't come up with an explanation for it. And so it wasn't until after his death that his name got put on that book.
Oh man, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so the answers that he had in 1940 when he wrote The Problem of Pain didn't work.
Yeah.
In 1960.
Yeah.
When he actually went through it. So there was no satisfaction from having all the answers. The experience was a much different thing. And then I would ask you, how would you reflect on, so one of the people that I profiled, Rosemary, the poet, does not identify as a Christian.
That was my favorite.
I thought it might be.
You got me. Yeah. I thought she was wonderful.
Well, she is amazing. She's amazing. Incredible. Yeah. And her story is incredible. Incredible pain. And her openness and willingness. You know, a lot of these stories are people who've had something that has happened and they've had a lot of time to think about it. And this was actually a very fresh wound with her son who had committed suicide.
Yeah. And 17, I think.
He was 17. And she started writing about it just a few weeks afterwards. And instead of going someplace by herself to process everything, she just let the world in. And was publishing her cries of anguish and lament and grief. And yeah, it is very remarkable. Mm-hmm. And she's, you know, she talks about praying. She talks about being overwhelmed by love.
Yeah.
Feeling, I think she may even use the word the divine at times.
I think she does.
But she does not call herself, does not identify as a Christian.
Right.
And, you know, I love the line. She said, well, my mom tells me I'm full of the Holy Spirit.
That's right. I know.
But she says, I don't know what to make of that. And I kind of like, oh, well, I agree with your mom.
I know.
Because that's where I come from.
Yeah.
Yeah. But she's a remarkable, remarkable person. And then what I loved, and Sophie Matinee Vanderwell is the person that reflected on that. And you know, my question for Sophie, who is a pastor who had a couple different times had dealt with suicide situations very intimately with people that were in her church. My question for her about Rosemary is, how come she's more Christian than the Christian people around us? Which is also a very interesting puzzle. And
it is a puzzle.
She personifies, she lives out, love in ways that, and forgiveness. And this, you know, her son was shunned by a group of friends, and that may have been something that compelled him to take his own life. And yet she encounters the father of one of those friends with nothing but love, and immediately has this reaction of, this was my son's decision. Your son didn't make my son do this. This was my son's decision, which is a very mature, you know, it's just not where we would normally be in the wake of something like that. I think most of us in the wake of a tragedy look for whose fault is this? Who can I blame for this? And somebody else that I could get angry at about this. So, I'll use the word powerful. I just thought that's an incredibly powerful story.
It is. And she talks about, when you describe that story, she mentions love giving, like she talks about love as though it is this external thing.
Like a capital L love, right?
Like what you might, like she,
like other people
like
would
she's
say
using
God.
It in place of God, right?
Yeah.
And she's saying it in that moment, it gave me a capacity that is abnormal, right? That was beyond human. And I would say I've caught glimpses of that in my life. The truth of that there is, like, that you can describe love as a force of its own operating in some way on its own. So I really appreciated just that idea, that she wasn't really giving herself credit in that moment for acting in the way she did. She tapped on his window. This gentleman whose son was a friend of her son who committed suicide. And, there was, you know, as you had said, a moment there where he was rejected by some of those people, but she was saying like, it was almost not, I don't want to say it was an out of body experience, but that the force of that was coming from outside. I thought that was a beautiful way to describe it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was one other thing she said here. Well, first of all, just that scene of her son committed suicide in the house of her parents, right?
Yeah.
And he did it in a room between the closet and the main room. He took the rings off of his fingers before he did it. And that she was obviously wary to go back to that house, but there was a circumstance in which she was sort of forced to do so. And she went there and sat there, took the rings off, and in a sense she tried to feel what the space, the feeling of the space, which I thought it's a super mystical, right? It also reminds me of the gentleman who opened a new office and another therapist came in and says, there's no stories here yet, right? This mystical, there are these mystical moments in it that I find really compelling. 'Cause what she felt, if I'm recalling correctly, is she felt like she was feeling what he felt.
That's profound.
It's just a beautiful, powerful story. And again, I'm not going to try and abstract it out. I just want to raise it as something that touched me.
Yeah. I thought it was so interesting that he chose to end his life in the threshold between two rooms, and that he was 17 years old, and that he was in the threshold in a sense, you know, he was a child and an adult at the same time. He was between these two. And, I thought that was very symbolic. And then her moving back into that and experiencing it and allowing herself to step into it and feel it and try to channel his own feelings was mystical and profound.
Yeah. One couple other things. She said, so Rosemary writes, the reason you realize something had happened is she typically writes a daily poem. Mm-hmm. You didn't get some for a little while and you realized that this was why. And she says about writing the poem every day, it doesn't have to be good, but it has to be true.
Yes.
And the good doesn't mean like goodness. She means it doesn't have to be a great poem.
A work of art.
And I love that line. The center, and by true, she doesn't mean like abstractly true. She just means it has to be true about reality.
It has
something
to be
like that.
Honest.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
I just want to say that I really like that, but I also could imagine reversing it. Like it doesn't have to be true, but it has to be good. If you take the good to mean goodness, as opposed to ultimate truth, right? Because your book is really about the possibility of goodness and growth without knowing truth, maybe, or without being sure, or without worrying about the ultimate truths of things. So I just really liked that piece of it.
Yeah.
And then one other.
You're making me think of
go ahead.
Desmond Tutu at the beginning of the book, the story.
Tell me that again.
Well, he would say, I can't answer that question, but let me tell you a story.
That's right.
That's my fallback. I don't know.
I know.
Yeah. But let me tell you about her and what happened to her and what her experience was.
Exactly. Yeah. It's really great stuff. All right. There's one other quote that I want to pull out here. If I can find it again, it's from, I don't know how to say his name, Atul.
Oh, yeah.
Gawande?
Yeah, the guy that wrote Being Mortal.
Being Mortal. Yeah. That's right. Let me see if I can find it here.
Yeah. That's in the chapter on dementia. Yeah.
He says, the battle of being mortal is the battle to maintain the integrity of one's life. And then he goes on to say other things there. And he's talking about, like, the integrity of one's life in terms of being able to be the type of person physically,
right,
sort of in the world and, without losing.
And mentally.
And mentally.
Yeah,
thank you.
The people, the person you've been.
That's right. Right. That's right.
Yeah.
But I thought there might be like a deeper truth to what he's saying, which is, I think, a part of this book, which is living, like choosing to be mortal and to live out life as sort of openly and honestly as possible is a type of integrity.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Sure.
That's not exactly what he's trying to say.
Right.
But the reason I bring that up is what I'm noticing is that people, a lot of people, not everybody, but a lot of people are desperate for people to speak honestly about what it's like to be alive. And that there's a kind of difficulty to that at times, because it may go against the grain of things you thought you knew or you understood or the things you thought you were supposed to be professing. I think McLaren says something like, stay true to reality, that there's something important about that. And that just, it struck me as I read this, that part of what happens with pain is it invites you into the truth of reality.
Yeah.
Like hard truths.
Yeah.
Real truths. I don't know.
I would say it invites you, another metaphor might be, it invites you into the deep end, mm-hmm, instead of staying in the shallow end.
Yeah.
And to embrace, to confront and embrace your humanity.
Yeah.
The fullness of your humanity. Yeah.
And that part of that is an incompleteness. Like there's something unfinished that we are constantly feeling. Something's missing. Something's not quite right. You also say, or somebody says, mystery, I think it's mystery, lies at the center of every human heart. That feels very true to me, though I don't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I don't know where it goes, except it feels like a truism about being alive and about, yeah, being a person.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it says something about the nature, like maybe there is something that teaches us about the nature of reality.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah. I'll just agree.
Okay.
I don't remember that quote. I might have said
I think
that.
I think it might be Sophie who said it.
Okay. It might be, or it could have been me. You made me think of another quote in the book from Tom Bogart, who said that, and I don't think I actually credited Tom, but it was Tom's quote. I think I said a friend.
Got it.
Because it's a choice you make as a writer sometimes. Is,
yeah.
If I'm going to introduce, if he was going to recur, he would have, I would have used his name. But
understood.
He just said that the experience of being human breaks our hearts.
Yeah.
And then all we have to give each other are pieces, mm-hmm, of broken hearts, and they're never enough.
Yeah.
We're never loved completely.
Yeah.
We never love completely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that gets into end of life stuff, because that's out of the dementia story with my mother, mm-hmm, and the fact that at the end of life, we often are encountering the fact that this relationship didn't go all the ways that I wanted it or I needed it to go. And so what am I going to do with that? And what happens often is that people die or they enter an advanced stage of illness, and you never have the opportunity to have that resolution with them. you know, so that's a whole nother category, but that's also reality.
Yeah.
And that we die in ways, that we don't imagine. We imagine ourselves dying in lovely ways.
I know.
You know, with our family gathered around us, and yet we die in care facilities being tended to by strangers, mm-hmm. is often the case.
Yeah.
And that's another reality.
Yeah. There was a gentleman in the book, I want to say maybe it was Mitch, but mm-hmm. he was a very upbeat, positive person, but he died in a way that was very difficult, his wife said.
Well, Mitch didn't die. His wife died. So
I got the wrong one.
Yeah.
Maybe it's that same chapter where there's two couples.
Oh, yeah. It's Cliff and Mary.
Cliff. Thank you.
Yeah. Cliff was the great, great, great guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yet died in a horrific way.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And chose, one of the things that Mary reflects on is that he chose to take medication to ease his pain that ended his ability to communicate. And he was a highly relational, highly communicative person. But he was in such agony that he chose that.
Yeah.
And she still is like, I can't believe he did that.
Mm-hmm.
You would have thought that he would have done something else.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a story that her story is that she's standing in the hospital room. Her husband is dying in this bed, mm-hmm. and they're in Colorado Springs and there are wildfires in their neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so she can look and see her husband dying in bed, or turn 45 degrees and look out a window and see the fire and in her neighborhood and assume that her house is being destroyed and wondering, what else am I supposed to give? You know, if someone who believes in God, I mean, really the question, she doesn't say it, but it's a question to God, is what else do you want from me?
Right.
You know, what else am I supposed to give?
Yeah. I'll end with this. One of the things that I had, so you met George, but we had a dog before that named Jim, who died tragically, got hit by a car in front of our house. So, and that was the first really sort of tragic death that I had to deal with. And one of the things that you mentioned in the book that resonated with me from that experience was the ability of other people to hold your pain, and just what a gift that is, and how hard it is.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say about it, except that as I read these stories and reflected, I kept coming back. Because I think you said, or somebody said in the, maybe it was a chapter on Roger, somewhere it said people saved him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And man,
the community around him. Yeah. Yeah.
What a gift it is to hold, to have the capacity, or to find the capacity to sit and hold the pain of another person, and how needed it is for the person.
And that's where other traditions have a leg up on evangelical Protestantism,
right?
You know, sitting Shiva, right?
Right.
Or just the experience of awake.
Yes.
And I'm sure there are other expressions in other religions that I'm not as familiar with, where there is much more entering into and sitting with and just being side by side with someone without necessarily having to say, oh, God needed another angel.
That's right.
Or as someone says to Quentin Henry, well, you have other children.
Yeah.
Right. After he's lost his daughter. The things that people say sometimes can be horrific. And yet we also have the capacity, to kill each other, and we have the capacity to heal each other.
Yeah.
That's one of the mysteries of humanity.
It is.
And so when we lean into the healing, it's a very powerful and wonderful thing.
It is. It's a lesson that maybe often presence is more healing than explanation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And in a sense, presence is easier. But in a sense, when people are going through these things, I think for a lot of people, presence is harder.
Absolutely harder. Yeah. Yeah. Because the reason that it's harder is because of your own fear of your own mortality.
Right.
And what this brings up in you, what it stirs up in you. It has nothing to do with those people and their situation. It has to do with you and your own insecurities about your own death,
yeah,
and your own unwillingness to look into the pain of your existence.
Right. But it's an opportunity,
mm-hmm,
to do so.
Yeah.
And what this book shows is there's so, so much richness available,
yeah,
in doing so. And also caring for someone you love in a time of need for them is a wonderful thing to do,
mm-hmm,
both for them and for you. So I hope you enjoyed our conversation. I'm glad to finally have it out there for you. Let this be a lesson to you. If there's something you're putting off, which you know really isn't that hard to do, just go do it. It's worth it. It's worth it. Thanks for listening.